used to protect the rights of a minority. Indeed, it has often been cited as a model for other nations struggling to reconcile the majoritarian features of democracy with a respectful constitutional role for minority rights. Ironically, Georgia Senator Johnny Isaacson reported in a Senate floor speech that he had asked a Kurdish leader in Iraq if he was worried that the majority Shiites would overrun the minority. Isaacson proudly said that the Kurdish leader responded, "Oh no, we have a secret weapon, filibuster." In order to cut down this occasional refuge of a scoundrel, the right-wing sect proposed to cut down the dignity and independence of the Senate itself, reduce its power, and accelerate a decline in its stature that was already far advanced. What makes their zeal so dangerous for our country is their willingness to do serious damage to our American democracy in order to satisfy their lust for a one-party domination of all three branches of government and the enactment of dogma as policy. They seek nothing less than absolute power. Their grand design is an all-powerful executive using a weakened legislature to fashion a compliant judiciary in its own image. They endeavor to break down the separation of powers. And in place of the current system, they seek to establish a system in which power is unified in the service of a narrow ideology serving a narrow set of interests. It is truly power that is key to understanding the cynical manipulation of faith and the assault on reason. Over time, this administration has focused more and more of its attention on the operations of this vicious cycle. And slowly but surely, its need for more and more power has become an all-consuming goal. It is love of power for its own sake that is the original sin of this presidency. As Aristotle once said of virtue, respect for the rule of law is one thing. It is indivisible. And as long as it remains indivisible, so will our country. But if either major political party is ever so beguiled by a lust for power that it abandons this unifying principle, then the fabric of our democracy will tear. Chapter 3. The Politics of Wealth. Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations and America's Declaration of Independence were published in the same year. In both, men were understood to be units of independent judgment, capable of making decisions upon the basis of freely available information, the collective result being the wisest possible allocations of wealth, in the case of the former, work, and political power, in the case of the latter. Capitalism and democracy shared the same internal logic. Free markets and representative democracy were both assumed to operate best when individuals made rational decisions, whether they were buying and selling property or accepting and rejecting propositions. Both works took for granted the existence of a public sphere defined by the printed word to which all literate individuals had equal access. And both shared a common enemy: despotic rulers capable of using arbitrary power to confiscate property and restrict liberty. The inner structure of liberty is a double helix. One strand, political freedom, spirals upward in tandem with the other strand, economic freedom. But the two strands, though intertwined, must remain separate in order for the structure of freedom to maintain its integrity. If political and economic freedoms have been siblings in the history of liberty, it is the incestuous coupling of wealth and power that poses the deadliest threat to democracy. If wealth can be easily exchanged for power, then the concentration of either can double the corrupting potential of both. Freedom's helix then spirals downward toward unhealthy combinations of concentrated political and economic power. That is what has happened throughout human history. Over and over again, wealth and power have become concentrated in the hands of a few who consolidate and perpetuate their control at the expense of the many. This default pattern has appeared in many variations and has been interrupted by rare and memorable exceptions, including ancient Athens and the brief Roman Republic. The establishment of the United States represented the most hopeful departure from that pattern. For the first time in history, large numbers of individuals were empowered to use knowledge on a regular basis to mediate between wealth and power. And because the only legitimate source of power in America was to be the consent of the governed, wealth was not to be bartered for political power. The derivation of just power from the consent of the governed depends upon the integrity of the reasoning process through which that consent is given. If the reasoning process is corrupted by money and deception, then the consent of the governed is based on false premises, and any power thus derived is inherently counterfeit and unjust. If the consent of the governed is extorted through the manipulation of mass fears or embezzled with claims of divine guidance, democracy is impoverished. If the suspension of reason causes a significant portion of the citizenry to lose confidence in the integrity of the process, democracy can be bankrupted. If citizens no longer participate, those among them who notice signs of corruption or illogic have no way to voice their concerns and summon the attention of others who, upon examining the same evidence, might share their dismay. No critical mass of opposition can form among individuals who are isolated from one another, looking through one-way mirrors in soundproof rooms, shouting if they wish, but still unheard. If enough citizens cease to participate in its process, democracy dies. Our founders worried about the dangers of concentrated wealth. Even Alexander Hamilton, the great conservative, wrote just before the Constitutional Convention about the real disposition of human nature that could lead to misfortune in the new nation. As riches increase and accumulate in few hands, as luxury prevails in society, virtue will be in a greater degree considered as only a graceful appendage of wealth, and the tendency of things will be to depart from the republican standard. The Roman historian Plutarch, whose histories were well known to many of our founders, had warned that an imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. The founder of capitalism, Adam Smith, wrote in The Wealth of Nations about the wealthy and powerful corrupt elites throughout the history of the world prior to the dawn of the New Age. All for ourselves and nothing for other people seems, in every age of the world, to have been the vile maxim of the masters of mankind. And of course, the Apostle Paul wrote in his letter to Timothy, "The love of money is the root of all evil." Dr. Samuel Johnson, who was also widely read by our founders, wrote in the 1750s that in a republic, reason has power to warn us against evil. It is that quality of alertness that our founders understood to be particularly vulnerable to the seductive appeal of power. In the words of Johnson's contemporary, Immanuel Kant, the most influential European philosopher of the Enlightenment, "The enjoyment of power inevitably corrupts the judgment of reason and perverts its liberty." As noted in the introduction, the idea of self-government became feasible after the printing press, and in its wake the Enlightenment, distributed knowledge widely to individuals and created a marketplace of ideas based on the rule of reason. As soon as decisions could be freely discussed and debated, reason began to displace wealth as the principal source of power. When the operations of a government are open to full examination by its citizens and subjected to vigorous discussion and debate, then the corrupt misuse of public power for private gain becomes more difficult to conceal. If the rule of reason is the standard by which every use of official power is evaluated, then even the most complex schemes to violate the public's trust can be uncovered and policed by a well-informed citizenry. Moreover, when ideas rise or fall according to merit, reason tends to drive us toward decisions that reflect the best available wisdom of the group as a whole. But reason alone is not enough. There must be a public forum accessible to all, within which individuals can communicate freely to illuminate unwise as well as illegitimate uses of power. Hannah Arendt, who wrote about totalitarianism in the 20th century, emphasized the importance of the public realm to this process. The only remedies against the misuse of public power by private individuals lie in the public realm itself, in the light which exhibits each deed enacted within its boundaries, in the very visibility to which it exposes all those who enter it. If the forum is not fully open, then those who control access become gatekeepers. If they charge money in return for access, then those with more money have a greater ability to participate. Good ideas in the minds of men and women who cannot afford the price of admission to the public forum are then no longer available for consideration. When their opinions are blocked, the meritocracy of ideas that has always been the beating heart of democratic theory begins to suffer damage. The conversation of democracy then comes untethered from the rule of reason and can be manipulated. That is exactly what has been happening in America. The replacement of an easily accessible print-based marketplace of ideas with the restricted access, television-based realm has led to a radical transformation of the nature and operation of the marketplace of ideas in the United States. When only those who have wealth can afford to enter the principal forum in which the majority of people receive their information, then those who can pay the price of admission automatically become more influential. Their opinions become more important than the opinions of others. The nation's priorities then change. To take just one of many examples, for the past several years, the felt need to eliminate inheritance taxes on the wealthiest 1/100th of 1% of the families in America, the only taxpayers who are still subject to it, has been treated as a much more important priority than the need to provide at least minimal access to health care for tens of millions of families who currently have no access to health care coverage at all. When wealth determines access to the public forum, it causes similar distortions during election campaigns. In modern America, the candidate who amasses the largest amount of money is guaranteed to dominate the semblance of political discourse that is used by the voters as the basis for making their choices. The communication between candidates for national office and American voters is currently based almost entirely on one-way 30-second television commercials purchased by the candidates at great expense with money donated to them largely by elites, many of whom are interested in purchasing specific policy outcomes with their contributions. Cash must be collected from those who have it. Those who have cash are typically motivated to give it to the candidates who promise post-election behavior that will be pleasing to the contributors, upon whom everything depends in this system. This behavior would not necessarily be pleasing at all to the voters if they knew what was going on. But both candidates and contributors are capable of ignoring the true interests of the voters, because the voters' opinions can now be shaped by mass advertising campaigns which can be purchased. Moreover, in the Congress as a whole, both House and Senate, the enhanced role of money in the re-election process, coupled with the sharply diminished role for reasoned deliberation and debate, has produced an atmosphere conducive to pervasive institutionalized corruption. The scandal involving disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff was only the tip of a giant iceberg that threatens the integrity of the entire legislative branch of government. Steps are now being taken in the new Congress to limit this threat, but the underlying problem is still present. The frequent response of reformers has been to propose new laws and regulations purporting to govern the amounts of money individuals and groups can give to candidates, to require more disclosure of these transfers of cash, and to prohibit certain particularly offensive forms of this institutionalized corruption. Predictably, however, since the underlying problem is the lack of effective participation by the people in reviewing and analyzing the decisions and policies of their elected officials, these new laws and regulations also escape effective scrutiny and thus are routinely violated, in spirit, if not in letter. New forms of old abuses outrace the legislative and regulatory process so completely that it would be humorous were they not the signs of a dangerous down spiral for our democracy. As long as individual citizens are not able to use logic and reason as the instruments with which they can dissect and meticulously examine ideas, opinions, policies, and laws, corrupt forces will shape those policies and laws instead. It is the public's lack of participation that empowers its abusers. It is the public's enforced muteness that prevents people from joining with others in a collective effort to once again wield reason to mediate between wealth and power. When the public merely watches and listens and does not have a speaking part, the entire exercise is fraudulent. It might be called American Democracy, the movie. It looks and sounds almost real, but its true purpose is the presentation of a semblance of participatory democracy in order to produce a counterfeit version of the consent of the governed. With no ability to test the propositions presented or explore the facets of policies not revealed, the public is often persuaded to endorse and applaud policies that are actually harmful to its interests. Since voters still have the real power to elect their leaders, those who wish to exchange wealth for power must do so in part by paying for elaborate public relations campaigns to try to shape the opinions of the millions who spend so much time watching television. At times it seems as if a genuine democratic conversation is taking place, but it flows mainly in one direction. From those who have raised enough money to buy the television advertising to those who watch the ads and have little effective means for communicating in the opposite direction. The word corruption comes from the Latin corruptus, which means to break or to destroy. Corruption destroys and breaks that trust, which is absolutely essential for the delicate alchemy at the heart of representative democracy. In its contemporary form, corruption almost always involves an incestuous coupling of power and money and describes the exchange of money for the misuse of public power. It matters not whether the exchange is initiated by the person with the money or the person with the power. It is the exchange itself that is the essence of the corruption. It matters not if the private enrichment is with cash or with its equivalent in influence, prestige, status, or power. The harm is done by the fraudulent substitution of wealth for reason in the determination of how the power is used. It matters not if the purchased use of power is seen as beneficial by some or even by many. It is the dishonesty of the transaction that carries the poison. When the decision-making process is no longer dominated by reason, it quickly becomes far more vulnerable to outcomes determined by the use of raw power. And the temptation to corruption grows accordingly. And sure enough, in recent years, there has been a series of gross examples of corruption and the fraudulent abuse of public power for private ends. The activities that now do the most harm to the health and integrity of American democracy are for the most part legal. And all of the abuses have one thing in common. The perpetrators have clearly assumed that they have little to fear from public outrage and that very few people will learn about their misdeeds. All of them assume an ignorant public. Bush would not be able credibly to label a bill that increases air pollution the Clear Skies Initiative, or call a bill that increases clear-cutting of national forests the Healthy Forests Initiative, unless he was confident that the public was never going to know what these bills actually did. Nor could he appoint Ken Lay from Enron to play such a prominent role in hand-picking members to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Lay's choices were conveyed directly to the White House personnel officer, and there is every indication that Lay participated in interviewing prospects, unless the president felt totally comfortable that no one would pay attention to an obscure policy apparatus like the FERC. After members of the FERC were appointed with Mr. Lay's personal review and approval, Enron went on to bilk the electric ratepayers of California and other states without the inconvenience of federal regulators trying to protect citizens from the company's criminal behavior. Likewise, this explains why many of the most important Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, positions have been carefully filled with lawyers and lobbyists representing the worst polluters in their respective industries, ensuring that those polluters are not inconvenienced by the actual enforcement of the laws against excessive pollution. The private foxes have been placed in charge of the public henhouses. And shockingly, the same pattern has been followed in many other agencies and departments. But there is precious little outrage because there is so little two-way conversation left in our democracy. Trees are falling in the forest, right and left, but they don't seem to be making a sound. This behavior could never take place if there were the slightest chance that such institutionalized corruption would be exposed in a public forum that had relevance to the outcome of elections. Thomas Jefferson warned that the concentration of power in the executive branch would lead to corruption unless there was full and vigorous scrutiny of its appointments by the public. Appointed positions in the federal government would, in effect, be auctioned off to the business interests most affected by the decisions made by those appointed. "Withdrawn from the eyes of the people," he wrote, "they," federal offices, "may more secretly be bought and sold as at market." In Bush's ideology, there is an interweaving of the agendas of large corporations that support him and his own ostensibly public agenda for the government that he leads. Their preferences become his policies, and his politics becomes their business. The White House is evidently so beholden to the coalition of interests that has supported it financially that it feels it has to give them whatever they want and do whatever they say. While President Bush likes to project an image of strength and courage, the truth is that in the presence of his large financial contributors and powerful political supporters, he is morally timid, so much so that he seldom, if ever, says no to them on anything, no matter what the public interest might mandate. Machiavelli illuminated this phenomenon 5 centuries ago in Florence. "A prince who would maintain his authority is often compelled to be other than good. For when the class, be it the people, the soldiers, or the nobles, on whom you judge it necessary to rely for your support, is corrupt, you must needs adapt yourself to its humors and satisfy these, in which case virtuous conduct will only prejudice you." Just as the appointment of industry lobbyists to key positions in agencies that oversee their former employers results in a kind of institutionalized corruption and the abandonment of law enforcement and regulations at home, the outrageous decision to brazenly grant sole source, no-bid contracts worth $10 billion to Vice President Cheney's former company Halliburton, which paid him $150,000 annually until 2005, has convinced many observers that incompetence, cronyism, and corruption have played a significant role in undermining U.S. policy in Iraq. Not coincidentally, the first audits of the massive sums flowing through the U.S. authorities in Iraq now show that billions of dollars in money appropriated by Congress and Iraqi oil revenue have disappeared with absolutely no record of where they went, to whom, for what, or when, and charges of massive corruption are now widespread. The president has rejected recommendations of anti-terrorism experts to increase domestic security because large contributors in the chemical industry, the hazardous materials industry, and the nuclear industry oppose these measures. Even though his own Coast Guard recommends increased port security, he has chosen instead to reject the recommendation, relying on information provided to him by the commercial interests managing the ports, who don't want the expense and inconvenience of implementing new security measures. He has also undermined the Medicare program with a radical new proposal prepared by the major pharmaceutical companies, also large campaign contributors. The Bush appointee in charge of Medicare was secretly ordered, we learned after the fact, to withhold from the Congress the truth about the president's proposal and its real cost until the Congress had finished voting on it. when a number of congressmen balked at supporting the proposal, the president's henchmen made a mockery of the rules of Congress by holding the 15-minute vote open for more than 2 hours while they brazenly attempted to bribe and intimidate members of Congress who had initially voted against the president and force them to change their votes in sufficient numbers to cause the proposal to pass narrowly. I will return to the deception involved in selling this program to the Congress in Chapter 4. These and other activities make it abundantly clear that the Bush White House represents a new departure in the history of the presidency. He appears at times to be so eager to accommodate his supporters and contributors that there often seems to be little he is not willing to do for them, even if it comes at the expense of the public interest. When he assumed office, President George W. Bush said, "I didn't. I swear I didn't get into politics to feather my nest or feather my friends' nests." The essential cruelty of Bush's game is that he takes an astonishingly selfish and greedy collection of economic and political proposals and then cloaks them with a phony moral authority, thus misleading many Americans who have a deep and genuine desire to do good in the world. And in the process, he convinces these Americans to lend unquestioning support for proposals that actually hurt their families and their communities. An increasing number of Republicans, including veterans of the Reagan White House and even the father of the modern conservative movement, William F. Buckley Jr., are now openly expressing dismay over the epic failures of the Bush presidency. The United States has survived many assaults on its integrity and has endured lengthy periods during which high levels of corruption twisted the nation's goals and distorted the operations of democracy. But in every prior instance, the people, the press, the courts, and the Congress restored the integrity of the system through the use of reason. This is different. The absolute dominance of the politics of wealth today is something new. During the Enlightenment, when reason often was given primacy over the church and the monarchy, the two traditional sources of valuation in the public sphere, the political system and the market system, were seen as natural philosophical allies. Our founders put their faith in the ability of a free people to use the power of reason to protect the republic against the evil they feared most, a concentration of political power that might develop into tyranny. Capitalism was seen as operating in a separate sphere altogether. Money itself was not considered the problem, because ultimately money has significance only to the extent that others agree to accept it in exchange for goods or services or behaviors. And in the new American Republic, it was inconceivable that power could be purchased with money. Power was to be allocated in a different sphere altogether, the democratic sphere, where the rule of reason was sovereign. The boundary between these two spheres has shifted back and forth over time and has often been a source of tension. Indeed, this fault line can be seen in the contrast between Adam Smith's phrase, "life, liberty, and the pursuit of property," and Jefferson's famous words in the Declaration of Independence, "life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Almost 2 years before the Declaration of Independence, the First Continental Congress had adopted a precursor to the Declaration known as the Declaration of Colonial Rights, in which they used the phrase life, liberty, and property. The phrase pursuit of happiness was first coined in 1759 by Dr. Samuel Johnson. In commenting upon James Madison's first draft of the Constitution, Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1787 that he intended to insist on attaching a Bill of Rights that would declare 1. Religion shall be free. 2. Printing presses free. 3. Trials by jury preserved in all cases. 4. No monopolies in commerce. 5. No standing army. This concern over monopolies in commerce would resurface repeatedly and demonstrated that even though democracy and capitalism were seen as complementary and mutually reinforcing, the internal contradictions of democratic capitalism were there from the beginning. Democracy begins with the premise that all are created equal. Capitalism begins with the premise that competition will inevitably produce inequality, depending on differences in talent, industriousness, and fortune. The two value systems have been the reigning philosophies in two different spheres of life. The fault line that marked the boundary between capitalism and democracy generated tremors during the first years of the Republic. Deep beneath the surface, much more powerful tectonic pressures were building. Slavery, America's original sin, forced a collision between the rock-hard edges of two ideas, property and freedom, that were pushing against each other with almost equal force. But in the last decades of the 18th century, these two tectonic plates seemed to make up a solid sheet of bedrock on which the American Republic could be based. One of the first tensions was in the requirement of property ownership for voting. John Adams wrote in a letter in 1776 that the same reasoning that led to a demand to drop the requirement of property ownership would lead to other demands. New claims will arise. Women will demand the vote. Lads under 21 will think their rights not enough attended to, and every man who has not a farthing will demand an equal voice with any other in all acts of state. It tends to confound and destroy all distinctions and prostrate all ranks to one common level. He was right in predicting that other demands would follow, even if he was wrong in his attempt to preemptively oppose them. Moreover, the logic with which Adams and others made property ownership a requirement for voter eligibility was weak. As a result, it was inevitable that the strong desires for freedom stoked by America's independence would break these two concepts apart. Initially, our founders valued and highlighted the role that property and wealth could play in promoting free self-government by guaranteeing a basis for independence of judgment on the part of citizens. They did not see wealth in and of itself as a bad thing. On the contrary, affluence, up to a point, was recognized as a positive force for securing political freedom. Moreover, one strand of the Protestant Reformation influential in America implied that prosperity might well be a sign that God had marked its possessor as one of the chosen few destined for heaven. When the American revolutionaries rebelled against the English king, they recognized in one another's property both a badge of independent thought and an incentive to band together. They were almost as concerned about the king's imposition of unjust taxes and his threat to their property as they were about his threat to their liberty. As Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." The landed gentry of colonial America were, after all, the heirs of the noblemen and merchants who had drafted the Magna Carta half a millennium earlier. Even then, economic independence from the king had fueled a desire for more political freedom. The requirement of property ownership as a condition for the right to vote was, in a way, yet another manifestation of the founders' mistrust of concentrated power. An individual who did not own property was likely to be dependent on others, and therefore under the sway of others, and thus not capable of basing his vote on reason that was unpolluted by the exercise of economic power over his judgment. This reflected their contemporary understanding of how political freedom had emerged from the Dark Ages. Individuals who had amassed enough property to feel a degree of independence from the monarchy were able to see clearly enough to steer by the light of reason. The founders recognized the ownership of property as an indicator, however imprecise, of competence in the world and rationality in thought, precisely the qualities one would want in a confederation of independent thinkers whose collective judgment would form the basis for self-government. Inevitably, however, the logic of democracy pushed aside the requirement of property ownership for voting. The most famous and most devastating argument was from Benjamin Franklin, who put the case for expanding the franchise beyond property owners very simply. "Today, a man owns a jackass worth $50 and he is entitled to a vote. But before the next election, the jackass dies. The man, in the meantime, has become more experienced. His knowledge of the principles of government and his acquaintance with mankind are more extensive, and he is therefore better qualified to make a proper selection of rulers. But the jackass is dead, and the man cannot vote. Now, gentlemen, pray inform me, in whom is the right of suffrage, in the man or in the jackass?" Unfortunately, neither logic nor morality was sufficient to dispel the corrupt understanding of property that was at the heart of slavery. Slavery was a living, breathing mockery of the guiding principle of democracy. The inclusion of the odious three-fifths clause in the original U.S. Constitution marked the prevailing moral blindness of America's founders where slavery was concerned. Even though sanctioned by the Constitution of 1789, it was an example of the corruption of democracy by the enforcement of an immoral property right. Abraham Lincoln's later decision to emancipate the slaves in the midst of the civil war that slavery caused came after a long history of a widespread abolitionist movement. Almost a century later, the American civil rights movement of the mid-20th century, like the abolitionist movement a century earlier, fought for the full political freedom of African Americans by using the language and symbols of the struggle by Moses 3,000 years earlier to free Jews from slavery. The natural resonance of its message came not only because of the predominance in America of the Judeo-Christian tradition that Jews and African Americans shared, and not only because the movement was a continuation of the same struggle that ended slavery 100 years earlier in the United States, it came also because we simply take it for granted that political freedom and economic freedom are intertwined. During the cataclysm of the Civil War, the United States was violently split apart, primarily on the issue of slavery. The line of division was not only between North and South, but between those who sought to perfect the logic of democracy and those who insisted on a perversion of capitalism by fighting to retain the right to own other human beings. Democratic capitalism, as it had been understood previously in America, was no longer the bedrock on which the nation had been founded, but two massive, separate monoliths that split apart and then came crashing violently toward each other. As freedom triumphed, the market for buying and selling human beings was destroyed. Lincoln's transcendent victory for the freedom of the human spirit saved the Republic, but in order to win the war, Lincoln was forced to rely on corporations that produced munitions, transported troops by rail, and focused the industrial strength of the North against the largely agrarian economy of the South. In the process, Lincoln removed many constraints that had kept the power of corporations in check during the first 7 decades of the Republic. Thomas Jefferson had expressed concern about what he saw as the encroaching danger in 1821, more than a decade after he left the presidency. "Our country is now taking so steady a course as to show by what road it will pass to destruction, to wit, by consolidation of power first, and then corruption, its necessary consequence. The engine of consolidation will be the federal judiciary, the two other branches, the corrupting and corrupted instruments." Echoing Jefferson, President Andrew Jackson warned against the dangers of too much corporate power, saying that it raised the question of whether the people of the United States are to govern through representatives chosen by their unbiased suffrages, or whether the money and power of a great corporation are to be secretly exerted to influence their judgment and control their decisions. In spite of such concerns, articulated in different ways by several of our early presidents, the role of corporations was still limited until the Civil War. Lincoln perceived the dangers he was enhancing and noted in 1864, "We may congratulate ourselves that this cruel war is nearing its end, but I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. As a result of the war, corporations have been enthroned, and an era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the Republic is destroyed. I feel at this moment more anxiety for the safety of my country than ever before, even in the midst of war. God grant that my suspicions may prove groundless." Lincoln's fears, of course, were not groundless. Only 22 years later, the money powers against which he warned, secured in the Supreme Court a decision that has been interpreted ever since in ways that pervert the purpose of the 14th Amendment, which was intended to confer upon former slaves all the individual rights granted by the Constitution to persons. The 1886 Supreme Court decision, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, has been cited for decades, especially since the conservative takeover in 1980, to uphold the proposition that corporations are, legally speaking, persons, and thus protected under the 14th Amendment. It was one of many developments that marked the ascendancy of corporate power in both the economic and political spheres of American life. By the end of the 19th century, the monopolies in commerce that Jefferson had wanted to prohibit in the Bill of Rights were full-blown monsters, crushing competition from smaller businesses, bleeding farmers with extortionate shipping costs, and buying politicians at every level of government. In the half-century between the American Civil War and the beginning of World War I, the transformation of work and the economy contributed with these many other factors to set the stage for several social movements aimed at using political power to remedy abuses and problems experienced by working people in the industrial age. The growing importance of mass production in manufacturing and railroads in transportation triggered the mass migration from the farms to the factories. The new concentration of wealth in the hands of industrialists contributed with many other factors to a perceived worsening of the cyclical depressions that had a harsher effect on families that were more dependent on paychecks than they had been when living on the farm. These hardships, combined with abuses, such as lax safety standards for those working with powerful and deadly machinery, child labor in industrial work settings, mines, factories, and other unhealthy environments, new threats to health and safety from the mass production and handling of foods and medicines, abusive treatment of employees, and unhealthful food, to form a list of grievances shared by large numbers in proximity to one another. In spite of the abuses associated with monopolies, concentrated wealth, and the corruption of politicians, America's public forum was still open and accessible to individuals, many of whom argued eloquently and powerfully for new laws to constrain these abuses. Upton Sinclair, Ida Tarbell, and the other reforming journalists who received the label muckrakers were able to awaken the conscience of America with their printed words, because printed words still represented the principal medium of communication in every part of American life. The progressive movement in the first decade of the 20th century gave voice and force of law to a growing desire to ameliorate these harms. Because reformers were still able to use reason to mediate between wealth and power, the boundary line between democracy and capitalism began to move back in favor of democracy. Theodore Roosevelt, 2 weeks before becoming president in the fall of 1901, after the assassination of President William McKinley, said, "The vast individual and corporate fortunes, the vast combinations of capital which have marked the development of our industrial system, create new conditions and necessitate a change from the old attitude of the state and the nation toward property." Halfway through his second term, after winning many battles against monopolies on behalf of the public interest, Roosevelt said in April 1906, "Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to befoul the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of the day." All of the reform movements that began in the first decades of the 20th century were based on appeals to reason. In the tradition of Thomas Paine, reformers laid out with clear logic a description of the abuses they saw, the suffering that resulted, and the need for governmental action to impose remedies that were not forthcoming in the market of its own accord. The reading public, upon absorbing these compelling narratives, gave them political force by repeating them to their elected representatives in the form of a demand that new laws be passed. In the late 19th century, the Industrial Revolution, urbanization, and the new connections linking east to west and north to south, including the railroads and the telegraph lines, were among the forces that led to the emergence of a mass market and fueled the consolidation of newspaper ownership into national chains such as the Hearst newspapers. Yellow journalism brought some of the worst abuses in the history of newsprint, appealing to the basest instincts of Americans, often with gross fabrications. Even though competition among newspapers in most cities was far more robust than it is today, the role of the pamphleteers and independent printing presses had long since begun to diminish compared with the growing power of newspaper chains. Soon, however, the nature of America's public forum would change even more dramatically with the introduction of the first electronic mass medium, radio. Whereas the printing press allowed the public to participate in the national conversation through letters, pamphlets, and newspapers, radio was something new. A one-way mass medium that instantly delivered the same information or content to every home with a receiver over a vast area. As professor of sociology Paul Starr noted in his book, The Creation of the Media, the national radio networks that established dominance in most markets by the 1930s, NBC and CBS, effectively reached every home in the nation. Radio was distinct not only in that it was a one-way medium, but also because it allowed political leaders and those who could afford to broadcast to enter the homes of listeners from thousands of miles away. It was the second characteristic that enabled radio to create the mass audience. Radio allowed the broadcaster to bypass traditional institutions such as political parties, labor unions, and associations to communicate directly with the listener. Anyone capable of broadcasting could join millions of families every night. The societal impacts of this revolutionary technology were very different in the United States from those in the rest of the world. In the United States, the defenders of democracy insisted that constraints be placed on the new medium. The equal time rule ensured that political parties and candidates for office received equal amounts of airtime. The fairness doctrine ensured that differing points of view were included in programming. And the public interest standard required all of those in the small group granted licenses to keep the public interest always in mind, upon penalty of losing the license to someone else if they did not. Elsewhere in the world, particularly in nations without a long democratic tradition, radio was introduced without the safeguards that were put in place in the United States. Moreover, the political atmosphere in much of the world was highly volatile during this interwar period. The U.S. victory in World War I had contributed to economic prosperity for the decade between the end of the war and the beginning of the Great Depression. But Germany had lost the war and was suffering the punitive economic impact of the Versailles Treaty. The resulting malaise set the stage for a radical transformation and combination of both the economic and the political spheres. World War I saw the end of the rule of the royal houses in Russia, Germany, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The echoes of ancient Rome could be heard in the transfer of power from the Kaiser and the Tsar, both titles derived from Caesar, and the fall of the last multi-state empire in Europe, which was a lineal descendant of the Holy Roman Empire, itself a pale imitation of the power that was Rome. And of course, in the rubble of the desperate and defeated Austria walked a seething, twisted, frustrated artist who would come to see himself as heir to the Holy Roman Empire, which he styled the First Reich, and the German Empire of the Kaiser, which he called the Second Reich. In 1922, less than 5 years after the armistice that ended World War I, Joseph Stalin was named General Secretary of the Communist Party in the newly formed Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and the leader of the new Fascist Party in Italy, Benito Mussolini, was named Prime Minister of a coalition government. A half year earlier, Adolf Hitler had been named Chairman of the new National Socialist Party in Germany. All three would require several years to consolidate their power. Each one mobilized support for his malignant totalitarian ideology by using the powerful new medium for mass communication that also debuted on the world stage in 1922, radio. Totalitarianism appeared in three distinctive designs. Nazism and fascism were fraternal twins and cousins to communism. Even though the first two saw the third as their mortal enemy, All three relied materially on propaganda delivered over the radio to engineer total state control over all political and economic power. Whatever their doctrinal differences, the result was the same in all totalitarian regimes. The freedom and rights of the individual were effectively eliminated. Without the introduction of radio, it is doubtful that these totalitarian regimes would have commanded the obedience of the people in the manner they did. As Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's minister of propaganda, would say later, "It would not have been possible for us to take power or to use it in the ways we have without the radio. The radio is the most influential and important intermediary between a spiritual movement and the nation, between the idea and the people." Similarly, Italian historian Gianni Isola, studying Mussolini's consolidation of power, wrote, "Broadcasting was born in Italy under fascism, and fascism used it right from the beginning for propaganda." Marco Palla, another Italian scholar writing about Mussolini, adds, "The effect of the state's ubiquitous presence, made possible by the means of radio, was probably more influential than any other instrument of propaganda." Propaganda became a science, but the word actually dates back to the Counter-Reformation, a period when the Catholic Church paid new attention to improving the effectiveness of its efforts at persuasion designed to win the hearts and minds of Europeans who were converting to Protestantism in large numbers. Perhaps for that reason, the word propaganda still does not have the same pejorative meaning in Europe that it does in the United States. But we understand the word and the phenomenon it represents as something new in the 20th century, and watching Goebbels' mastery of propaganda allowed us to understand how sinister it can be. Arbeit macht frei. Work is freedom. The sign above the entrance of the Nazi extermination camps symbolizes the evil uses to which psychology-based persuasion was put by the Nazis. Psychology-based communication was first developed by another Austrian of Hitler's generation, Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew. Bernays adopted the revolutionary insights of his uncle to create the modern science of mass persuasion, based not on reason, but on the manipulation of subconscious feelings and impulses. Bernays, considered the father of public relations, left Austria long before the Nazi rise to power and immigrated to the United States, where he transformed commercial advertising and began a similar transformation of political persuasion. The combination of psychologically driven public relations and electronic mass media broadcasting led to modern propaganda. Reason was displaced not only by the substitution of broadcasting for print, but also by the science of PR as the principal language by which communication occurs in the public forum, for both commercial and political purposes. One of Bernays' first breakthroughs involved his work for the American Tobacco Company, when he interviewed psychoanalysts to discover the reason women in the 1920s would not smoke cigarettes. Upon learning their view that women of the era saw cigarettes as phallic symbols of male power and thus inappropriate for women, Bernays hired a group of women to dress and act as suffragists. They marched down New York's Fifth Avenue in a parade for women's rights and, upon passing news photographers, pulled out and lit cigarettes, proclaiming them torches of freedom. The strategy worked to break women's resistance to cigarettes. A second victory involved another corporate client, Betty Crocker. Bernays discovered that women were not buying cake mixes because they felt ashamed to present their husbands with a cake that required so little work. Bernays advised changing the formula to require the addition of a fresh egg, and once again, the strategy worked. Women felt they had done enough to deserve praise for their baking, and the cake mix started selling robustly. Bernays' business partner, Paul Mazur, understood the larger significance of the new techniques of mass persuasion. "We must shift America from a needs to desires culture," Mazur said. "People must be trained to desire, to want new things, even before the old have been entirely consumed. We must shape a new mentality. Man's desires must overshadow his needs." Advertising, George Orwell is often quoted as saying, is the rattling of a stick inside a swill bucket. Amid all these lofty terms, it is worth remembering what we're talking about. What should have been most disturbing about the introduction of these new techniques is the threat they posed to the internal logic of capitalism. The invisible hand of Adam Smith was giving way to invisible puppet strings manipulated by marketers who were now able to manufacture demand. As noted in the introduction, John Kenneth Galbraith demonstrated more than 50 years ago the raw power of electronic mass advertising, which, when fueled by enough money, was capable of artificially creating demand for products that consumers had had no idea they needed or wanted. Advertising's distortion of the pull of demand complicates Adam Smith's metaphor of the invisible hand, to say the least. This distortion amplifies the internal contradictions between capitalism and democracy. These contradictions are far less glaring than were those between communism and democracy by any measure. Galbraith is said to have quipped, "Under capitalism, man exploits man. Under communism, it's just the opposite." Another consequence of the new importance of mass electronic advertising in the marketplace is that there are now many industries in the United States where competition is effectively limited to companies that have the concentrated wealth necessary to mount huge marketing campaigns. The inherent quality of the product in question and its price still matter a lot, of course, but the ability of new competitors, including small entrepreneurs, to suddenly have an impact on competition with a genuinely better mousetrap is sharply reduced. The resulting concentration of corporate wealth in the hands of a smaller number of larger conglomerates has occurred at the same time that political power has come to be more concentrated in the hands of a smaller number of people. There is, as a result, a powerful motive for those who seek large gains from corrupt schemes to find ways of suspending or interrupting the rule of reason as the standard by which their behavior will be measured. But not even the most ambitious swindler could have imagined that the rule of reason could have been weakened as a dominant force in the public forum in the manner that it has following the transition from a print-based forum to an electronic media-based forum. Inevitably, Bernays also began to apply his psychological and mass marketing insights to the sale of political ideas. "If we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind," he said, "is it not possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing about it? The recent practice of propaganda has proved that it is possible, at least up to a certain point and within certain limits." In 1922, as the world was first taking notice of radio, Mussolini, Hitler, and Stalin, Walter Lippmann first proposed that friends of democracy should also adopt the techniques of propaganda, though he did not use the word. He used instead a phrase that to me is even more chilling: the manufacture of consent. This catchphrase was later seized upon by opponents of his philosophy, including MIT professor of linguistics Noam Chomsky, who later chose as the title of one of his books, Manufacturing Consent. Though well-meaning, Lippmann was cynical in his analysis, elitist in his prescription, and completely unrealistic about the damage that would be done to democracy if the ultimate decisions were made by a specialized governing class and then sold to the people with propaganda. That is precisely what happened with the invasion of Iraq. "The knowledge of how to create consent will alter every political calculation and modify every political premise," Lippmann said. "As a result of psychological research, coupled with the modern means of communication, the practice of democracy has turned a corner. A revolution is taking place, infinitely more significant than any shift of economic power." In the following decade, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt used radio to communicate over the heads of newspaper editors and other intermediaries to bring about a dramatic shift in the boundary between democracy and capitalism when he built public support for the New Deal agenda. But the legal constraints placed on the radio medium in the United States prevented its use for the type of cynical political manipulation that occurred in many other countries, in Europe, Asia, Latin America, and Africa. These constraints were removed during the Reagan administration in the name of free speech, and the results have been horrendous. Our founders could never have imagined that the marketplace of ideas would change so profoundly that the consent of the governed, the very source of legitimate political power in a democracy, could become a commodity. And radio, of course, was the precursor of an infinitely more powerful broadcasting medium, television. As noted in the introduction, television is also a one-way medium. Individuals receive, but do not send. They listen, but do not speak. They are given information, but do not share it in return. They do not comment on it in ways that others can hear. Therefore, automatically, their ability to use the tools of reason as participants in the national conversation is suspended. There is an entirely separate set of consequences related to this change in the nature of the public forum, and it is not rooted this time in the impact on perceptions, or the impact on the operations of the brain, or the internal balance between reason, fear, and faith. It is rooted this time in the sheer economic realities of the physics of the medium itself. Because it has, until recently, been a centralized system, it requires large capital investments to simultaneously control or purchase the production of programming and to distribute it from a single point to hundreds of millions of people. This has led to the control of television programming and distribution by those with large amounts of wealth. In addition, the number of voices in the media is shrinking, while the influence is growing for those whose voices are heard. This process of ownership change is already so far advanced that it has alarmed even conservative Republican members of Congress, causing them to join with members of the Democratic Party to oppose the efforts of the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, to make the world of information even safer for monopoly. For the first generation of television broadcasting, the physics of the medium included reliance on the electromagnetic spectrum for distribution and the separation of one channel from others by enough wavelengths that the net result was severe scarcity of available frequencies suitable for distribution. Two consequences flowed from those physics. One, the scarcity meant that only a few frequencies or channels could be used in each individual geographic area. Two, government was thrust into the role of deciding who would be given the privilege of using these scarce resources and according to what criteria. The economics of broadcasting influenced the next three generations of television distribution, cable, satellite, and internet. In each case, the specific design and physics of the distribution system influenced the economic structure of the system. With respect to cable distribution, cable was a natural monopoly in the sense that an electric utility or terrestrial telephone network is a natural monopoly. Because it is in the interest of the community to limit the number of cables and lines attached to wooden poles around the community or buried underneath the streets, the economics of a utility push it toward a natural monopoly. Therefore, the same two vulnerabilities to corruption appear. One, you need massive amounts of wealth to construct and maintain and operate such a system.